Welcome to the Thomistic Institute podcast. Our mission is to promote the Catholic intellectual tradition in the university, the church, and the wider public square. The lectures on this podcast are organized by university students at Thomistic Institute chapters around the world. To learn more and to attend these events, visit us at thomisticinstitute.org.
We are going to talk about social doctrine of the church. I don't know if you are familiar with it. This term, social doctrine, refers to the teaching of the popes on economic, social, and political questions since 1891. It is this body of teaching, above all, that we will be exploring together this evening. For those who are not yet familiar with it and would like to study it more deeply, I recommend referring up this book. The Compendium of the Social Doctrine of the Church. I think it's easy to find it on Amazon or on libraries as well. You can have many information about this social doctrine of the church in this book. But this evening we are going to talk about a specific topic: is the Catholic Church anti-capitalist? Can you hear me? It's okay?
Yes.
And you understand my bad English? My French accent is not a problem. Okay, thank you. So I would like to mention that this topic is actually related to Pope Francis' pontificate, but also to the church social doctrine. In France, at the start of Pope Francis' pontificate, a leader of the left-wing party, La France Insoumise, actually wrote a surprising blog post called Vive le Pape. You can see it here. His name is Jean-Luc Mélenchon. Maybe some of you know this politician in France. And some commentators at the time even called Francis a red pope because of his strong critics of capitalism. Now, the question isn't just about Pope Francis' stance on capitalism. Some people might say, well, he's from Argentina and influenced by theologians who were traditionally critical of capitalism, and that's why he writes so much about it. But actually, the link between capitalism and the church's social teaching is much older than Pope Francis. For instance, a well-known Jesuit theologian named Jean-Yves Calvez wrote back in 1994 that the church had never fully endorsed capitalism itself. It often critiques the excesses, but not the entire system. As you can see on this map, capitalism is the most widespread economic system worldwide, even in the global south. So it's a big question why the church social teaching focuses on the excesses and not on the system as a whole. The core issue we are talking in this presentation can sum up as, is there really a Catholic doctrine on capitalism, or does the church social teaching just respond to particular situation of a time? We need to remember what Pope John Paul II wrote in his 1987 encyclical Solicitudo Rei Socialis, where he emphasized that the church social doctrine isn't meant to be a third way between liberalism and collectivism. It's its own category. It is therefore a matter of understanding what the church can say about economic system without herself proposing one. My goal in this presentation is, first of all, to help us better understand the different ways the church social doctrine had defined capitalism throughout history. And secondly, I would like to explore what kind of attitude or behavior a Christian can adopt in daily life when it comes to this topic. Is it okay? Okay. So, first consideration, what I called a tension economic treatment. I will try to explain what I mean under this expression. defining capitalism in the negative. So to start the first, this first part of my presentation, I want to emphasize that the church social doctrine has a kind of cautious and nuanced approach when it talks about economic systems. In other words, capitalism in the church's teaching is often defined in relation to socialism rather than in standalone economic system. For example, Pope Leo XIII, you can see him here on the right, and in his encyclical Rerum Novarum in 1891, he made it clear that Christians and Catholics couldn't agree with Marxism or socialism, especially because of their views on private property. And this is a clear opposition to Karl Marx on this point. What's interesting is that also Pope Leo was influenced by thinkers like Thomas Aquinas on this specific issue. He stressed private property as part of natural law in a way Thomas Aquinas didn't exactly say. And the reason he did that was to firmly oppose communism as the main threat. You can see different quotation of this encyclical of Pope Leo XIII. Most scholars of the church social teaching interprets this as Pope Leo XIII deliberately choosing not to include a direct critic of capitalism because he wanted to keep the focus on opposition to Marxism as the main threat at this time. This isn't just a question for Christian theology or church social teaching. In fact, in many areas of economic reflection, it's always challenging to pin down a single clear definition of capitalism. A lot of economists and scholars point out that sometimes capitalism is defined just in opposition to Marxism. So it's kind of defined in negative, like it's a hollow definition that's filled in by what it's not, rather than by what it is. So you can see that the opposition of Marxism is the goal of the Pope at this time, and the Church condemns socialism because of its will to abolish private property, and capitalism, through our name at first, was implicitly defined as the opposite of Marxism, so not as a subject. And it's interesting to see that after Rerum Novarum, so after this encyclical written by Pope Leo XIII, popes didn't really define capitalism, but later texts had to grapple more directly with the economic reality of their time. For example, in the 1931, during the Great Depression, Pope Pius XI wrote the encyclical Quadragesimo Anno. That was actually the first time the word capitalism appeared in an encyclical. And Pius XI made a really important distinction. He suggests that there are different kinds of capitalism, some of which the church could find more acceptable than others. This was partly influenced by the idea of a German Jesuit theologian, Ottwald von Nellbräuning, who helped draft Quadragesimo Anno. He was trying to keep a balance. On the one hand, continuing to oppose Marxism, and on the other hand, finding ways to engage with the modern world. So at first, we have this kind of initial definition in the church social teaching where capitalism isn't really defined as a standalone economic system. Instead, it's defined in contrast to Marxism, with a strong emphasis on private property. In other words, the church wasn't condemning capitalism as a whole, only the excesses of it. Is it okay? Yep. So you have the first point here, the economic definition. So capitalism is not defined as an economic system. It's more to say non-Marxism. So, but I think it's a problematic economic treatment to have such a definition. We can say that this balanced position is in fact a prudent one. As we have said, the Church does not wish to propose a specific economic system. Yet something beyond her opposition to Marxism, one might apply to her a French saying. I don't know if the translation is good, but I hope Father Connor can help me if it's not. He who embraces too much holds on too little. Is it correct or is it understandable? Okay. In French, we say, qui embrasse trop mal étreint. So I study personally economics, and I must admit that the Church's position on economic system are sometimes difficult to read, even hard to interpret with clarity. So as we move into the second part of the presentation, we see that understanding the Church's social doctrine of capitalism isn't straightforward. It's not just a black and white stance. On the one hand, thinkers like, for example, Michael Novak argue that the Church can be seen as an ally of liberalism because it supports private property and the free market in certain ways. On the other hand, other thinkers, other scholars like Richard Beyer, for example, see a kind of kinship with Keynesian ideas, especially when it comes to the Church's focus on fair wages and the importance of employment as more than just a simple market transaction. Finally, some scholars note that the Church emphasizes on the moral dimension of giving, as highlighted by Pope Benedict XVI, brings it closer to heterodox economic views that value the role of gifts and social bonds, not just transactions. To move beyond this difficulty, which I believe prevents us from speaking credibly to the contemporary world, we may need to take a step aside. Rather than speaking about capitalism as an economic system, we should turn our attention to the philosophy and anthropology on which it rests. Indeed, I believe this is precisely the point where the Catholic witness is most needed today in the economic, social, and political spheres. Not by proposing ready-made solutions or debating the technical elements of this or that system, but by taking a step back, by uncovering the philosophical and anthropological foundations that modern thought no longer always perceives. So we see that it's difficult to pin down a single definition of capitalism within the Church social teaching, and one helpful perspective is to look at what scholars call the spirit of capitalism. Thinkers like Albert Hirschman, for example, but Max Weber, Werner Zombart, Stefano Zamani as well, show that when capitalism emerged, especially in the 18th century, it was seen as a break from the traditional Christian suspicion of wealth. In the Bible, especially the New Testament, there is a strong theme that wealth can be spiritually dangerous. For example, you can see it in this quotation from the Gospel according to Matthew, Jesus says that it's easier for a camel to go through the eye of a needle than for a rich person to enter the kingdom of God. And St. Paul even calls the love of money the root of all evil. And you have, yes, here, you have other quotation from the book, from the letter to the Ephesians, for example. And this attitude was echoed by early Christian writers like St. Justin, for example, who said, you have other texts here, for example, the Didache, but I would like to focus on this text written by St. Justin in the second century, who said that becoming a Christian meant turning away from obsession with wealth and focusing on the kingdom of God. I'm always deeply impressed by this text from St. Justin. Sometimes I dream of doing a kind of street interview outside churches, asking people, for example, you know, I was a sociologist before, so that's why I like making interview with people. But I like to have this such interview outside my churches, asking people, for example, what really changes in someone's life when they take the message of Christ seriously. Unlike what we see in St. Justin and in the early Christian, I'm quite sure that very few people today would speak about the relationship with money and with material goods. When I was preparing, I don't know if it's the case of Father Connor, but when I was preparing for my priesthood, we did exercises to learn how to hear confessions with an older priest. And this older priest told me, you know, you will hear very little about money in confessions. And that is rather surprising if we take seriously what we have just mentioned. In addition, I often do a small exercise with my students. I ask them which two capital sins they consider to be the most serious. I won't make this exercise with you tonight, but I can give you the result of this exercise with my students. Every year, I get approximately the same answer. The two capital sins they consider to be the most serious are pride and lust. It's okay, pride and lust, okay. And that answer corresponds to what most moral and spiritual treatises say today. Yet, until the 17th century, the two most serious capital sins were pride and avarice, and not lust. It's interesting to note that lust has dethroned avarice in the modern perception of what is morally grave. One key point is that capitalism isn't just a system, but also as certain spirit, and that spirit often conflicts with Christian anthropology, as we see here with all this element. For example, Adam Smith, who is considered the founder of economics as a discipline in the late 18th century, argues in The Wealth of Nation and also in the theory of moral sentiments that individuals pursuing their own interests rather than aiming directly at the common good ultimately creates wealth for society. We can see it clearly in these two texts. In the first here, we can see that Adam Smith criticized the attitude of monks and their sobriety of life. And this very famous quotation, he points out that if my baker makes good bread, and you know it's something very important for French people, especially for a French person, if my baker makes good bread, it's not out of love for his customer. If he pushes himself every morning to make the best bread possible, it's because he fears that his customers may go to his competitor instead. According to Smith, what motivates us to surpass ourselves is not our concern for others, but rather our concern for our own self-interest. This is an anthropological foundation of modern economy science and of what we call the spirit of capitalism. Smith wasn't saying that it's morally good to have such a position. He just say that it's more efficient. And that idea of efficiency became a cornerstone of economic thought. But it's important to recognize that this view comes from a specific anthropology that doesn't align with the traditional Catholic moral teaching. It's crucial to understand, especially, the difference between individual interest on the one hand and the common good in Catholic social teaching on the other hand. You can see the difference between all this notion here. The common good doesn't mean sacrificing personal goals for the sake of the group. Rather, it means that my good and the good of others are fundamentally aligned. In other words, when I seek the common good, I'm also seeking my own good. We can see this on this slide. Sorry, it's a bit... Okay. The common good here and individual interest here on the right. So the common good means that both this man and this woman reflect together on what is truly good. And if they are believers, the greatest good is the contemplation of God in eternity. By contrast, the general interest or the individual interest means that I think about my own interest and let the others think about their own interest, and at the end, everything is supposed to converge. But it's very important to understand that the movement, the object, and the goal are not the same. In one case, the common good, I seek a moral good in cooperation with others. In the other case, individual or general interest, I pursue a material benefit without taking the other person into account. This stands in contrast to other systems. Liberalism often puts the individual first and the group second, while Marxism or collectivism does the opposite. The Church's perspective on the common good is that there is no conflict between the two, between the good of the individual and the good of the group are one and the same. So here is a little story to illustrate the difference between individual interest and the common good. In France, you know, I often use a car sharing service where you book a seat in someone's car and share the ride and the cost. I don't know if it exists in Ireland. Otherwise, in France, it's called BlaBlaCar. But and for me, it's a great way to meet people, especially people who might be far from the church. And I usually wear my Dominican habit because I often leads to deeper conversations. And I had two experiences that highlight this difference. In the first, I was a passenger on a long trip, and it took the driver, and I was quite disappointed, because it took the driver 3 hours before she even asked what I do. Even through, I was wearing my medieval habit, but we spent 3 hours together, and finally she asked, "What are you doing?" So we talk a bit, and when I explained my life, her main question was just, "How are you happy? Êtes-vous content?" in French. I don't know if content in English has the same meaning, but content in French is not so deep as happy. So I wanted to explain to her that the difference between being content, being content, and being truly happy, but I didn't insist. I simply answered, "Yes, I'm happy." And then we went on to talk about something else. First experience. It was a simple conversation, and we respected each other's spaces, but it was very much just about not disturbing each other too much. That's more like individual interest. We coexist without really challenging each other. In the second experience of car sharing, I was the driver, and within 5 minutes, my passenger asked if I was religious, and then basically told me I was the opposite of happiness because I denied certain pleasures in my life. So it was an impressive experience for me, but I was told, but I really interesting discussion where we both had to engage and challenge each other's ideas about what's good is. That's more like the common good perspective. Even if it's harder, we actually engage deeply and try to understand each other's views. So, as we've seen, the spirit of capitalism isn't really rooted in Catholic tradition. This brings us then to an important question. Does the church social doctrine address this spirit of capitalism? The answer is yes, but it took time. And it's precisely what I would like to show you in this third part now. Yes. The church was slow to define the spirit of capitalism, but gradually this definition took shape and become established within her social teaching. So we see this especially after after Pope Leo XIII, the early drafts of his famous encyclical Rerum Novarum explicitly named capitalism as the heir of usury. Yet Leo XIII finally avoids the term to preserve dialogue and avoid ideological polarization. There were 4 preparatory drafts for Rerum Novarum written entirely by a Jesuit and a Dominican. In each of these versions, which can be found in the Vatican archives, capitalism was explicitly condemned. However, this condemnation disappears in the final version of the encyclical. Later popes, so you can see here a quotation from the drafts written by Tommaso Cigliari, so the Dominican, and Matteo Liberatore, the Jesuit, and finally the final version of Rerum Novarum. So the spirit of capitalism appears later, discreetly but decisively, in the social teaching of Pius XI and his successors. So later popes like Pius XI really started to critique economic systems that were built purely on competition and individualism. They pointed out that this kind of approach really doesn't align with Catholic social teaching. Pius the 11th and then Paul the 6th also made it clear that a Christian can just fully embrace either Marxism or a kind of pure market liberalism without running into problems for his faith, especially. And finally, Pope Francis has been very clear about criticizing this so-called invisible hand of the market and highlighting that the Church is wary of the spirit of capitalism, what it's detached from moral values. So all in all, we see a growing clarity in the Church's document that this purely individualistic competitive spirit is at odds with Catholic social teaching. So essentially, what we can see is that at the very beginning of the Church social teaching, the idea of the spirit of capitalism was present, but quite discreet. Over time, especially by the time of John Paul II and his encyclical Centesimus Annus, the definition became much more explicit. In other words, by 1991 and onwards, the Church stand on capitalism and its underlining spirit was much clearer. Many scholars agree that after that point, you really can't say that Church doesn't have a position on capitalism. And we can see it on this quotation of Pope John Paul II encyclical. So you can see that the first part, shown in black in the slide, offers an initial definition of capitalism. It corresponds to the economic definition we discussed earlier. John Paul II indicates that the Church is not opposed to a free economy, nor to entrepreneurial freedom. In fact, the Church is rather critical of an excessive role of the state in economic affairs. But, and this is the portion highlight in red, the Pope is strongly opposed to what we have called the spirit of capitalism. Even though John Paul II doesn't use that expression explicitly, doesn't use the expression the spirit of capitalism, it's clear that what he called capitalism in the negative sense corresponds exactly to what we mean by the spirit of capitalism. And several leading scholars of Catholic social teaching have debated this definition. Some, like Michael Novak, argue that John Paul II went out of course here, revealing a certain, I quote Michael Novak, European unevenness toward money. However, most agree with Cardinal Reinhard Marx, who is a specialist of social teaching of the Church, who maintains that John Paul II perfectly captured the Church's position. A free economy is not condemnable, but the spirit of capitalism can never be embraced by a Catholic. Yes, you can live in a capitalist world, but you must be cautious not to absorb the spirit of capitalism that can undermine your faith. That clarifies things, at least in theory. You have this philosophic definition. But in practice, it's not the same. It's not the same. It's another matter. In other words, it's a bit like saying you can play in an orchestra, but you don't have to follow the conductor if the conductor is leading you away from your values. That might not be entirely realistic, but that's the tension. The Church acknowledges you might live in a capitalist society, but warns that following the spirit of capitalism can be dangerous to your Catholic faith. We must therefore consider the final problem. What is the relationship between these two elements, the economic and the anthropologic element in daily Christian action? What follows if one takes the second definition seriously? So we can actually see the final part of our presentation, how Catholics engaged in these issues seek to respond to the tension between the structures of capitalist economy and the spirit of capitalism. So we can actually see four different attitudes among Catholics when it comes to these two definitions of capitalism in the church social doctrine. I will try to clarify these four attitudes, and we'll see the connection to Thomas Aquinas by the end. The first attitude is to reject. Is to reject both the spirit of capitalism and the capitalist structure itself. However, since it is no longer possible to do so by proposing an entirely alternative economic system, the idea is to build local alternatives instead, concrete initiatives that embody different economic and social values on smaller scale. An example is this movement. I don't know if you know it. It's called the Economy of Communion. It's a movement founded by the Focolari in Italy with Chiara Lubich. You can see her here with John Paul II. They propose an alternative way of organizing economic life that isn't just about creating a whole new economic system, but rather about infusing economic relationships with principles drawn from the social teaching of the church, a bit like a Catholic spirit of capitalism. This system invites companies to function according to the model of Benedictine monastery. Each month, the business leader convenes a chapter similar to a monastic chapter, during which every member of the enterprise, regardless of their position in the hierarchy, is given the opportunity to speak about the strategy, for example, of the firm. The goal is to define a corporate strategy that doesn't rest on profit maximization, but rather on shared responsibility and a pursuit of common good. The challenge with that first attitude, refusing both the spirit and the structure of capitalism, is that it's not always practical if you are not part of a specialized community like the economy of communion. Not everyone can work in that kind of environment. So the question become, for example, how to act outside these structures. It's beautiful, but if you are not lucky enough to work in such a firm, how can you do? So that's why that brings us to a second attitude, which we might call the reformist approach. A good example for that is the Dominican friar Louis-Joseph Lebret, who helped draft parts of Populorum Progressio, the encyclical of Paul VI. This approach accepts working within a capitalist structure, but tries to resist or transform the spirit of capitalism from within. It's about engaging in dialogue with the world as it is, trying to reform it rather than withdrawing completely. For example, Father Louis-Joseph Lebret initially criticized the spirit of capitalism in his early works. However, realizing that such criticism isolated him from other economists, he gradually abandoned his fundamental critique and chose instead to focus on specific economic subjects with a Christian orientation, in particular the question of development economics. Of course, this raises its own questions. Is it coherent for a Catholic to work inside that system and still try to stand apart from the spirit of capitalism? It's a tension between participating in this economic structure and still trying to keep your values intact. So there is a third attitude, which basically involves accepting both the capitalist structure and the spirit of capitalism. This approach is often associated with what's called the theology of democratic capitalism, a perspective linked to thinkers like Michael Novak. I already talked about it. Who was influential in the 1980s and had ties to people like Ronald Reagan, for example, in the United States. In this view, because capitalism has produced a lot of positive outcomes, it can be seen as something fundamentally good, and the market economy can even be viewed as a kind of communion of saints pursuing their own callings. It's a more optimistic theological take that sees the free markets are compatible with Christian life. But there is a risk here of what we would call consequentialism, saying that something is good simply because it has good outcomes. The Church and the Bible want that the spirit of capitalism, if it encourages greed or overlooks human dignity, can be justified just by pointing to good results. For Christians, the moral dimension matters just as much as outcomes. So, in my view, none of these three attitudes are entirely satisfying. Each of them has its own limits. The first approach, trying to create this little alternative economic cells, might not be practical for everyone. The second, engaging with the capitalist system, but sort of compromising on resisting its spirit, raises the question of coherence. And the third, fully accepting the spirit of capitalism, seems to clash with the Church's moral reservations and the biblical critique of that mindset. So maybe we can think of a fourth attitude drawing on someone like Thomas Aquinas or modern thinkers like Alasdair MacIntyre. This would mean acknowledging that, yes, we have to live and work in this world, but we also need to maintain a critical stance. We don't simply surrender to the spirit of capitalism, nor do we have to create a whole separate economic universe. Instead, we live in this tension, constantly trying to align our economic life with a deeper moral vision of the Church. In other words, it's not about fully rejecting the world or fully embracing it on its own terms. It's about living in the world critically and faithfully using the Church teaching as a guide. So what you are pointing out, so what I want to point out is a kind of false attitude that drove from Thomas Aquinas, and perhaps I tell you thinker like Alasdair MacIntyre. In Aquinas' thoughts, we find this emphasis on practical reason and moral realism. That means we do have to live in the world as it is, recognizing that sometimes we might have to operate within systems that aren't ideal. For Aquinas, for example, usury was seen as morally problematic, but he also acknowledged that in certain circumstances, people might find not better option for the time being. It's not that we understand it as a good in itself, but we understand the practical limitations we are dealing with. In the same way, this false attitude means we can live in a capitalist world without fully understanding the spirit of capitalism. We remain critical, we remain guided by the church's moral teaching, and we do the best we can within the context we have. It's about balancing realism with moral integrity, just as Aquinas would advise. And I believe this point is very important for economic life, but also for our ability to live as Christian within society. You know, Thomas Aquinas places great emphasis on what particular virtue, prudence. To be prudent doesn't mean to be afraid to act. To be prudent means to align the end one seeks with the means one possesses. In today's world, Christians often define themselves by their radicality. And on certain questions, this is indeed a good thing, to be radical. Yet the Christian must also be defined by his prudence. In that sense, he resembles a mountain guide. A good mountain guide doesn't simply tell the group he's leading, "You see the summit up there, that's your goal. Now find your own way to get there, since I have shown it to you." The good guide keeps the summit in sight, but he also adapts the path according to the weather and the physical condition of his group. And I think too often Christians describe a summit, an idol, but in doing so they accomplish only half of their task. They must also think in practical terms about how to accompany others toward that summit. They must do so knowing that our world is not perfect. The weather sometimes is bad. We know it here. And that not everyone walks at the same path. This implies two very concrete points. First of all, one can hold to an ideal while accepting not to walk along the straightest path to reach it. For example, one can walk within a capitalist world and still criticize the spirit of capitalism. Secondly, it's important to preserve a certain plurality in Christian behavior. Some may resist in certain social structures externally, others must learn to accommodate them. It is not only the most outwardly radical behavior that defines a faithful Catholic. So in conclusion, we must always walk with two poles: radicality, so as not to lose the sight of the goal, and prudence, so as to walk wisely toward it. So that is how I would conclude. Even through this discussion, leave several open questions. Broader question, yes, up. Broader question which I have only evoked here in list form here. But once again, I thank you sincerely for your passion for my bad English, and I hope we can discuss all this topic later. Thank you very much.
Thanks for listening to this lecture on the Thomistic Institute podcast. The generosity of people like you makes this podcast possible. If you enjoy these talks, please consider showing your support at www.thomisticinstitute.org/donate. Your donation of even a dollar helps us reach more college students and many others with the powerful truths of the faith, and it ensures that we can keep publishing top-notch lectures on this podcast. Thanks a lot.